This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple. Tonight's show features readings by Leslie Scalapino, whose latest collection is It's Go in Horizontal, Selected Poems 1974 to 2006. Vermont poet Tom Absher, who will be reading from his latest book, The Paper Rose, and a tribute to Daniel Cassidy, author of How the Irish Invented Slang, The Secret Language of the Crossroads. Danny died on October 11th of 2008. We'll begin with Leslie Scalapino. This is what you'll find on the jacket of her new book, It's a Go in Horizontal. Internationally recognized as one of the most innovative writers in America today, Leslie Scalapino has written award-winning work that persistently challenges the boundaries of its many forms, poetry, prose, plays, and more. This volume provides a dazzling entry into her oeuvre, including work from sequential and serial poems written over 32 years. The poems embody ideas about writing and formal inventions, demonstrating how one invention leads to the next. Three series are selected from the long poem Way, about which Philip Whalen said, "Scalapino makes everything take place in real time, in the light and air and night, where all of us live, everything happening at once." Leslie Scalapino teaches at Mills College and is a former faculty member at Milton Avery Graduate Program of the Arts at Bard College, the San Francisco Art Institute, and the Otis Art Institute in Los Angeles. This reading took place in her East Bay home.
The UC Berkeley Press brought out my selected poems recently, or just brought it out. It's called It's Go in Horizontal, Selected Poems 1974 to 2006. So I thought I'd read several little selections from that, starting with something, a little passage from The Return of Painting, The Pearl and Orion, a trilogy that was written back in, I think it was 1991, it was. And recently I was writing a piece for a Wesleyan anthology about my work, and I had this thought, which I came to looking at the results of my selected and just thinking about it, I realized that I conceive of the senses as being paradise, regardless of whether event or experience is pleasure or pain. I don't conceive of positive events on one side and negative events on the other, like subject or story, but all the senses open and active. The writing, in being the location of all of the senses at once, would be some kind of state of bliss. And it's also not a notion of the individual either being or seeking wholeness, as if that's some kind of idea that's a social fabrication. Anyway, this is from, also in The Return of Painting, The Pearl and Orion, I had the notion of a text that you could kind of bask in that would also be always being in a present time, and the lines of the text being as if paragraphs or single lines like a scroll unfolding, and that one would be in the present time of each line, that would be each paragraph. So this is a passage from it. Woman waiting on long yellow grass. There's the blue sky. She's waiting, turmoil, and some buzzards are on the grass. That is before her. Slow, low gutting on the long yellow grass. And the buzzards are on the corpse that is amidst the grass. Hams forward and then back, waiting. And ahead and behind that in the grass. In the blue sky. On the slope. Hams extended forward, waiting. On it. Rolled down the grass. And the buzzards on one. Cluster flapping. That is in the blue sky, cluster flapping on a corpse, waiting on, indentation in the wave of slopes and buzzards, starter on a corpse flapping, up, hams waiting up, in it. The buzzards in it had been on the corpses here and there, flapping cluster in it on one, the whir in that, the mixing amidst it in the indentation. Pushed into going into the ocean, which is at the edge of this, on the rise, with the others who are churning. The water is heavy, the rise of it. The living have struggled into it. A shot cracks into it, and a corpse boils, the living churning around it, the lighted sea. The other feels a crack in her side, the hip that is soaked, hanging in the heavy water. Blood that comes into the sea from the humans, and wading in who are shooting, they keep on going, cracks of shots in it, churning, heavy mass, swimming, the rolls in the waves, having the hip that had hung in the water, in the long grass, weeds entwined, dragging the hip leg line. Slept deeply before, the man on the mounted pickup truck emerges through grass, a shot in the heavy grass, the leg lying twined in the weed and rolling into indentation. Buzzards fly up from a corpse in the indentation flapping on it, which is turned over on its trunk, trunk of woman low wading now, her on the long grass, rolling into indentation of reddish cattle with gentle white faces who are kneeling in it, the kneeling gentle cattle beginning to stand, frightened. The leg is soaked, the kneeling cattle standing, settling, the twined grass in among them, slept in a matted indentation with them, the men out of the mounted pickup truck overseeing, muffled. Lying by the steer, it is not devil. There's a puff, crack of shots, muffled. Morning comes. It does not come. How can it? The thick, slurred cattle kneeling, eating in the light air. The lightened, white air. Wheeling oneself forward on a cart. A sled of the leg. On the sidewalk, asking money of the passers-by. In it, on the sled, it is free for the one, they think, for that other who's asking for the money. On the sled, it is. A soldier, affected by the unburied dead, covered with the buzzards in the valleys, and not turn that inward. And then he's in the light air, and not figure out how it unfolds. Wheeling on the sled, having slept in the indentation, deer simply have ticks which become huge until they drop off. A huge tick in the side of having waited. They began singing, soldiers she meets on the road or a choir, and they begin singing. Into the area of just pulp, only that. One realizing I have to do this myself. The leg is soaked. She goes on the sled. There's a sandbar out along stretching on which are corpses, the buzzards had encrusting flapping, the light air is coming up, no planet or orb, an orb floating, now it's gone, and out tangled in the yellow grass on it, the woman waiting, there's a corpse in the grass, the buzzards sapping it, whirling, it's far gone, in the light air, it can't be that in the long yellow grass. The hams stretch out and running down the slope in the yellow grass, arms twirling, flapping, being in the grass. There are weeds. It's dawn. Encounter sensitive man, as in trunk of seal, lying on her rearing. They're coming. The light air is coming up. Entwined thrashing around, he puts it into her again, him rearing, on the trunk. He withdraws it, takes it out. The weeds are still. He puts it back in, on the trunk. The trunk, the bulb of it in her after the dawn. There was this crescent moon hanging with a bright planet in this bright blue night sky. They were low in it. The sack of corpse wavered bulb that was created by some behavior. They, the orbs, weren't held. Birds come glancing, sucked and then released by the one or the people in their behavior. It's completely irrelevant. The market creating the jewel, and be that completely. What is bothering you that you had to be on the street? I had 5 children. Why be in the comic book? We simply are in it, yet we must try to be in it. I don't know how. Girl is seen walking on the street, black on the bright, billowing sky. She comes up to the other and then is on the other side with the puffed, illumined sky before the other. Reading memory only is REM. Some homeless people are by the Safeway where they congregate, opening tins someone has given them. As she goes outdoor and by them towards billowing sky, they're sitting holding the tins, the sky appearing to move. These guys who attack her in the sense of bullying don't do that to the individual. It's to someone, the instigating bully, as a way of flattering them so that they go along with him in order to have that. It is not friendship with him or to them. It's flattery which he reflects back to himself. And seeing this, supposing one sees it, it will not do anything. They see that or don't. And it isn't there. They're not interpreting it that way. Then seeing it on the retina is reading memory only. As there is no relation to exteriority, the women emerging into the Safeway who might have beaten the boy at that age, there was no commentary coming to them. There is not that coming from them then. The men opening the tins, there is no commentary. Who cares from or to them? It's invisible to them who interpret this, but if one sees that it is that, it is not so. And so this has to be serial, with it being in front. Desperation is serial, and so can't be seen by them. And so it has to be inexperience that is in front. As the comic book is invisible to them, for it is inside, they can be in it. So that's from The Return of Painting, The Pearl and Orion, actually from the last section. And I was interested in the notion of a comic book, and that's what I meant by single lines making a present time that one would continuously be in as the reader. This is from, continuing to read from my selected, it's from New Time. And I imagined this as a rim, spelled R-I-M, that's a way of concentrating and being attentive also to the present time, making a seeing of material and thoughts and whatever one's in as being just a rim that's like a line of horizon that one concentrates on, and everything comes up to that and moves away from it at the same time. There's no time to oneself. Is the dawn occurring? It's rim. It has no rim. Pressure, so that the mind comes into the social unit. It isn't done by people. There's no time to oneself. It's done by people only. The night, the dawn there. The constructed unit being no time to oneself. Standing, being completely alone, standing as walking. Flowering trees float the sky, packed luminous sky of ocean, a sky that is an ocean. The group, not having time for oneself, opens that one floated sky. Sleep-deprived one, pressure so that the mind comes into the social unit only. The flowering trees that have nothing but swimming on sky. We cannot speak as to concentrate on the constructed unit, nor sleep much, and that causes an actual harmony. Serial, or it's there after a while, not based on the similarities of the people. The night is exhaustion, rains, luminous night while running to the rise. That's dawn is when running to the rise. Later, the rise is the floating people. They're going into houses, killing. Is the fact. The fact is delicate, in existence even. People love patricians. Form is exhausting. One has to exist there. The physical body has no brown night. If the nature of this is struggling wall of birds flying that aren't on their own, if we're not going to do this with people. There isn't any existence. I'm relieved by the wall of birds. One is, in fact, struggling and not with one's, their existence. It is a fact. This is a light relief. Rain through huge red leaves, sea above and below, sea floor and sky, freezing night, though leaves sea is at day, rain, man's lying, breathing beside one is enhanced from, and it being in night, night itself, not from freezing night. Night can not be enhanced from the man's soft breathing, which is beside one, as rain in it, day, which is the vast red leaves sea, isn't by the one's horizontal lying breathing, rain lying, pouring sheets. One is by someone as not enhancing rain, only breathing, running together on the rise, is horizontal lying at night. Physical strength in leaping, hanging, falling, which is sometimes on each other, so that hanging they are floating as swaying by each other in the air, reflected as if they were walking on the ground, whereas they're physically beating their own bodies on a wall that is there. The social unit only, as it's in one's frame and flesh. People sprawled leaning on wall of subway underground, in passing it. They can't rest. Can in subway underground, but not at all. They aren't resting. They have to run as was to the rise, that is their motions. People sprawled, leaning on walls, resting, are finding or have to find a way to do it. The mind is action literally, not departing from that, being events or movement outside, which is inside. So the mind is collapsing into and as action. I can't rest at all now. This is despair. Poor Dante, if action of events, my mind, were the same as resting, brought to that, in the way the physical body rests outside, one is not having a rim. Understanding rather than just get rid of one's mind and body in traveling at all, the physical body, inner, must continue to move only. The day only, no. Night, which is delicate, is. Walking in the street once with someone shopping for a dinner with others, the sole event of that is, for nothing, pressed up to the thin day ahead of one being, in this present, at the same time, the events, a rim collapsing in one, differing times on the same present, and one's, no, but one fears that's too fast. The two events are only spring obstructions, as one won't be in be them at the present at the same time, being, no, but. Cold, freezing red sky dusk, slice, reduction not existing, walking only as clear one outside, dark roses are in it, as freezing reds slice, a half of the night scene, which isn't there yet. Sky only is there, at all. Bright, dark roses, not bud, ever, in the slice only.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You just heard Leslie Scalapino reading from her latest collection, It's Go in Horizontal, published by the University of California Press. Up next, Vermont poet Tom Abshire, followed by a tribute to Daniel Cassidy. Tom Abshire recently retired after 40 years of college teaching in literature and creative writing. Most of his teaching was done at Goddard College and Vermont College. He received a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in the English Renaissance and an MFA in poetry from Goddard College. Over the years, he was awarded two National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships in Poetry and a grant from the Vermont Council on the Arts. His books of poetry include Forms of Praise, The Calling, The Invisible Boy, and his latest book, The Paper Rose, which he'll be reading from tonight. Abshire also has a collection of essays published by Park Street Press, Men and the Goddess. As a tip of the hat to Abshire, here are Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong performing Moonlight in Vermont. Abshire's reading will begin immediately afterwards.
They sing down the highway and travel each bend in the road. People who meet in this romantic setting are so hypnotized by the lovely evening summer breeze wobbling of a meadowlark, moonlight in Vermont.
Setting so hypnotized by the lovely
evening summer breeze wobbling up a meadowlark, moonlight in and I am moonlight in Vermont.
Moonlight in Vermont.
War math. When you're in warrior training, learning how to kill an enemy soldier, remember to steep yourself in the study of advanced subtraction. First, subtract the man from his mother and father who carried him in their arms of love and patience into his adulthood. Subtract from them their hearts at their son's military funeral, where they exchanged their lives for the folded flag from his coffin, that his mother will clutch to her breast while his father stares into the emptiness of the middle distance, now his private room, his assigned cell to the end of his days. Next, subtract from the man his wife, her face full of light for him. Subtract forever that light between them. Subtract his young son, already with a trace of his father's demeanor about the nose and eyes. Subtract from the boy's entire life the holy need of his father's presence and example and approval. Subtract the daughters and sons planned yet unborn. Subtract his tribal community of family relatives and friends, those people who now realize how much they knew themselves by knowing him. To kill another soldier, remember to subtract from him the 12-volume encyclopedia of his night and day dreams over a lifetime. That impenetrable Kabbalistic text of image and mystery, unfolding the richness of his double, triple, quadruple selves, and subtract from the man, and this perhaps is the highest mathematics of all, his own death, his private death, the death he would have met had he lived out his allotted life, that unique destiny set in motion at birth in his stars, his cells. When you have the enemy in the crosshairs of your sights and pulling the trigger is not going to be an option, make certain you have done the math. Tree of Life. When I caught my first trout, cleaned, cooked, and ate it with my father next to a stream in Colorado, I remember fingering the delicate lace of bones joining head to tail, that soft white tree upon which the fish had hung its life. In military school, when it rained, they showed us World War II training films, how to recognize syphilis, how to dig a foxhole, and how to be a sniper, meaning which enemy soldier do you shoot first in order to kill the other two before they run, when all three are walking single file in an open field. My long descent into disastrous trouble with my draft board, the FBI, the Justice Department, and my family and friends had its seed planting that rainy afternoon as I watched the crosshairs of the sniper's rifle enclose each enemy soldier's head and explode it. Enemy soldier. An eighth grader, I was too young to fully grasp the concept and could only imagine each man as someone like me, a kid, his youth unlived, his best stories still waiting for him up ahead, in that field, or hidden in the branches of the tree of bones growing inside him. Jamie and Tommy. We were boon companions. I lived on Divine Road and he on Ironwood, but our houses were connected by a footpath, our very own Santa Fe Trail across two vacant lots. After years and thousands of hours in each other's company, we learned to live in unison, like those guys in old vaudeville acts who walked across the stage together inside one pair of pants. Depending on the changing menu at his house or mine, we took our meals together, eating in sync, the same number of black-eyed peas on our forks. We drank jointly from faucets, using our hands the way Tarzan did, folded like two leaves into a cup, the water running down our chins. So when we had to pee at the same time and stepped outside to write our signatures in the dirt, making an overlapping monogram of our single lifeline, we took it as a sign we were brothers. As early as first grade, Jamie and I wished to be Superman. Stripped to underpants, bath towels pinned at our necks, we raced from the back of my brother's room, through a hallway into my room, onto the second floor landing, and leapt at my father's door, arms outstretched like Superman's, falling on the big bed. We repeated this routine all afternoon, dashing through the empty house like midgets crazed on comic books. Since we had the same blood, we promised that if one ever flew, the other would share the power. Jamie died in a car crash at 16. Whenever I visit the cemetery and stand at the foot of his grave, my soul has to strain hard to do the work for both of us. It lifts off the ground heavily, rising slowly over rooftops into the sky, a sky containing a cow and some flowers, perhaps a moon, our one soul ascending like two Chagall lovers, separate and joined forever.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple. You just heard Vermont poet Tom Abscher reading from his new book, The Paper Rose. On Saturday, October 11, 2008, Daniel Patrick Cassidy died of pancreatic cancer. He was only 65 years old and had a lot to look forward to. Many of us were looking forward to it with him. Cassidy was an award-winning author, filmmaker, and former college professor. He founded and co-directed the Irish Studies Department at New College in San Francisco, and was also co-founder of the wonderful Crossroads Irish American Festival, an annual event in San Francisco. I was reading for Crossroads at Litquake on Saturday, October 11th, along with Jack and Adele Foley and Eddie Stack, and dedicated my poem, She, to him, knowing his time was coming soon, but not knowing it would be right then. His name was mentioned many times that night. He seemed somehow present. Danny was an energetic man and wore many hats in his lifetime. In addition to the accomplishments I've already stated, he was a news assistant at the New York Times and their United Nations Bureau. He was a professional musician and composer, playing everywhere from juke joints to Carnegie Hall. He even gigged on The Tonight Show, performing with George Carlin, Lily Tomlin, and others. His documentary, Civil Rights and Civil Wrongs, about the political troubles in Northern Ireland, was nominated for an Emmy Award in 1996. His film, Uncensored Voices, was broadcast on PBS, as well as in Japan, Europe, and Canada. He became an ardent Irish nationalist as a result of the Bloody Sunday shootings in Northern Ireland in 1972. He married his wife, Claire, in 1983. Early this year, I aired an interview I conducted with Danny when his book, How the Irish Invented Slang, The Secret Language of the Crossroads, was published. It remains one of my favorite interviews, and in tribute to Danny, I'd like to play part of it again tonight. Please enjoy Daniel Cassidy. Tell us how you began writing this book. What was the event that brought you to writing How the Irish Invented Slang?
It was a bit of a fluke, and an Irish fluke means a rare reward, a rare occurrence, but particularly a rare reward, fluke. In December 2000, I inherited my first Irish dictionary, and it was not a happy occasion. A young friend of mine named Kevin O'Dowd had died at the age of 37 and left me some Irish books in his will. And I took the books home to my wife, Claire, and I was showing them to her. And it was heartbreaking. I mean, to look, it's the first thing I'd ever inherited, and it was breaking my heart. And one of the books was a little tiny beat-up Focla Poca, which means pocket dictionary in Irish. Poca means pocket. Focla is a dictionary. And I held up this beat-up old dictionary for Claire, and I said, you know, I'm going to have to toss this, Claire. I'm too old to learn Irish. It's too beat up to give to the library, so I'm going to toss it. And Claire went, Danny, you can't throw that dictionary. Mm-hmm. It's a gift from Kevin. It's sacred. And I thought to myself, she's right. She says, why don't you put it on your nightstand every night and look up a few words? And after 24 years of marriage, I do listen to my wife occasionally.
It's a good thing you listen to her this time.
And it is a good thing because I credit her really with the creation of it. And that's what I did. I put this little dictionary next to my nightstand and began looking up a word a night before I went to sleep, before I put out the light. And then one night, a light went on in my head. I had the sense that some of the slang words and phrases that I'd been raised with as a kid in a working-class Irish-American family in New York City, that some of these actually despised slang words often or looked down upon, words like glom, to grab, duking it out. And there I found the Irish word duke and hammer and thumping it out. In Dutch, Irish dush, trouble. Say uncle. All of us have used, or a lot of us say uncle. I used to wrestle with my brother and we were like 5 or 6 years old and I'd hold him in a headlock and I'd go, say uncle, say uncle. Mm-hmm. And we never knew why we said uncle. And there was the word unicle in Irish, which means mercy, quarter.
Oh, for
figuratively, I surrender. Yeah. And a whole other bunch of words like this suddenly seemed like they could be from Irish.
Now, you say that this slang was despised. Why is that?
Well,
is it the working class language that is despised itself, or is it?
Absolutely. Certainly the language, the first dialect or language that I was raised with as a child in a working class Irish-American family would have been what you would call today, oh, he's got a Brooklyn accent or a New York accent. Mm-hmm. And it was very much despised. It was an accent you wanted to get rid of, at least in my generation, the post-war generation. We were among the first Irish-Americans en masse to begin to get educated and to go to college. That's not to say they weren't Irish-Americans before that, particularly on the West Coast, that were making it into college. But on the East Coast, certainly, it's post-World War II that we begin entering colleges in large numbers. And frankly, this idiosyncratic New York accent, working class accent, and its slang would certainly be a marker of coming from an uneducated working class background. So it was often despised, discarded, and looked down upon. And yet, some of the greatest works of American literature and drama have been written in this very vernacular. Mm-hmm. So that's why it was despised. It was a marker of class.
And that may tie into why people like Noah Webster believed that the Irish language was just lost, or the Irish had lost their language totally.
That's right.
It wasn't going to pay any attention to the slang that was coming out of these areas.
Right. As my friend Peter Quinn said, the attitude of many dictionary makers in the 19th and early 20th century really was informed by kind of an ideology of what they call Anglo-Saxonism, which is frankly one of the ideologies that gave birth to eugenics, which put Anglo-Germanic people at the top of sort of the eugenics tree. And lo and behold, the Irish were down there at the bottom, along with African-Americans and others. People often forget that today with our obsession with skin color. But that certainly Irish people within an English-speaking empire were looked upon as the laborers, the maids and housekeepers, the lower classes. Mm-hmm. And we were the maids and housekeepers and laborers, frankly. And so their attitude was, well, how could these people have any influence on the imperial English lingo?
When you researched your family history, you found out that your father's family had been Irish speakers in Brooklyn, and that your great-great-grandfather fled the Great Hunger in Ireland.
Right? And that is true, yes.
That's when, in case anyone doesn't know, about 1 million Irish people died in Ireland,
that's
and
right.
another 1 million people left Ireland and came to
that's
America
right.
and other countries.
That's right. As I say, between 1845 and 1850, 1.2 million Irish people die of starvation and attendant infectious diseases like cholera and typhus, and another 1 million leave Ireland as if it were a burning building. You merely need to look at the ship's logs, which are all available, of many of the famine coffin ships, as they were called, leaving Ireland then, and you will see literally 8 and 9 month pregnant women, women still nursing babies, 80-year-olds, the whole mix of families, which indicates these are people literally practically leaving in their nightclothes. As I said, women with an infant at the breast, normally that'd be the last time a woman would want to travel. But they travel then because they had no choice. And so, yes, it was in this period that I discover that my mother's family wound up in the slums of New York and on the East River in Brooklyn and in the Five Points in the 1850s. And we also discover, in fact, that my father's family that come over much later, my father was orphaned. So we knew very little about my father's family. And we discover, in fact, that in 1920 in the census for Greenpoint, Brooklyn on the East River, lo and behold, there are the Cassidys, and they're speaking Irish in Greenpoint in 1920s.
Interesting. At the end of the first chapter of your book, you ask the question, did Irish Americans remember the Irish language without knowing it? This is one of the questions that came to you when you were reading that Irish dictionary and recognizing words and phrases.
That's it. That question, really, I tell my students all the time, I think like many teachers, the answer is not that important. What's most important is the question. If you're going to be writing a thesis, a dissertation, or even a senior project or a paper, make sure you ask the right questions. The answers will flow from that. That's the question which ultimately came for me, because as you mentioned earlier, I had some insights on my family and on our language. I knew that the dictionary makers and that H.L. Mencken in 1938 had said in the American language that it was a curious fact that Irish Americans, for all their verbal and literary agility, had contributed almost no words to the English language. I think he listed 3 or 4 smithereens, speakeasy, and a few others. He said exhaust the list. In 1999, Professor Terence Dolan, in his Dictionary of Hiberno-English, also confirms Mencken's thesis of no Irish contribution to American language. And he says, my dictionary confirms this puzzling fact. He even says it's puzzling. It was a singularity, as scientists would call it, that didn't make sense. Here we have French, Germans, Scandinavians, Yiddish speakers, African Americans, Native Americans, Asian Americans, all contributing copious amounts of words to the American language and its vernaculars. And yet the only group that I'm aware of, particularly the only major ethnic group, that all scholars seem to agree have left no impact on American vernacular slang and speech, were the Irish, and it just didn't make sense. When I began translating some of these simple words, for instance, snaz in Irish is spelled S-N-A-S. Glom, which was my nickname as a kid. My mother used to call me the Glom. Uh-huh. I say, Ma, what do you call me a Glom for? She says, I call you a Glom because you're always grabbing other people's stuff, right? Other kids' stuff.
You're glomming onto it.
And I'd say, Ma, where does the word Glom come from? She'd say, I don't know. What do I know? Maybe it's Yiddish. I says, Mom, we're not Jewish. She says, well, I don't know where it comes from. Forget it. We're always forgetting it in my family. There, G-L-A-M in an Irish dictionary means to grab. So when I saw these words, that's when I said to myself, okay, is it possible we remembered the Irish language without knowing it?
Right. And what a good question, obviously. Now, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that in the same area, in Irish town,
yes,
Brooklyn, New York, there was a large African-American population as well. How can you know which words came out from the Irish and which words came from the African continent? And mm-hmm. did they create slang together somehow?
I think we all created slang together. Interestingly, the Irish, who came in millions and millions and millions to North America, many of us landed, let's be frank, in the slums. We landed in some of the poorest neighborhoods in New York, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, New Orleans. My family, one of our three neighborhoods, the Five Points, Irishtown, and Greenpoint, was this place called Irishtown in Brooklyn. It's where the Brooklyn Bridge actually today hits the shore of Brooklyn. It's next to the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And it was one of these interesting sort of crossroads neighborhoods. About 20,000 inhabitants. It was called the Old Fifth Ward. And like all the Irish neighborhoods in New York City, it wasn't completely Irish. Even the most Irish of the Irish neighborhoods in New York City, for instance, were only 50 to 60% Irish. The rest of the people in these neighborhoods were Scandinavians, Yiddish speakers, Sicilians, Italians, and yes, importantly, African Americans. There was a key, very old African American community smack dab in the middle of Irishtown. And would your listeners be surprised to know that intermarriage happened in these old slum neighborhoods? The Five Points, another of my family's neighborhoods, was also a neighborhood that had Irish and African Americans in it. And I actually recently, in some of my own research, have uncovered a neighborhood in the 8th Ward in New York City in the 1870s and 1880s, called by the pejorative term Rotten Row, on Sullivan Street and Spring Street. And this neighborhood was made up almost totally of Irish African Americans. So you have hundreds of Irish African American families intermarried living in one neighborhood in the 8th Ward. Well, their African people would have picked up the Irish language literally at the breasts of their Irish-speaking mothers. Vice versa, the language would also pass the other way. That is, African words, words of Gullah, words of African slang would also pass into the Irish community. We were intertwined or helixed together in these neighborhoods like a Celtic triple spiral. This was a chorus of 100 languages. All I'm saying in this book is that one of the languages was Irish.
This is fantastic. Yeah, and you are claiming that because it's just been so excluded historically.
It's interesting that today I found that Irish and Irish American history in North America has been covered up by what I call a shroud of whiteness. That today it seems like multiculturalists on the left have become more enamored of the word white than the Ku Klux Klan was in the 1920s. So even today when I read academic texts by progressives, that is people that I would generally agree with, they're constantly using the word white to describe, for instance, the Irish immigrant experience or the Sicilian immigrant experience or the Basque immigrant experience or the Yiddish Jewish immigrant experience. And I feel that the word white, which is English, which means colorless as well, serves these communities very poorly. It's an English word. My people didn't speak a white language. They didn't come from the white land. If you had a white political party, I wouldn't vote for it. If you played white music, I don't want to hear it. Oh. And for me, white has really added to this covering up and this loss of this rich ethnic roots culture. One of the roots are Irish and Gaelic. That's all I'm saying. But it's interesting how even progressives have often forgotten, or as I say, they forget about it. They've forgotten about their own ethnic roots. Well, some of us haven't.
You mention Eugene O'Neill in your book. His father was a famine immigrant, raised dockside in Buffalo, New York, and he used Irish-American vernacular in the voice of Yank in his Pulitzer Prize-winning play, The Hairy Ape. And he said to his son once that the critics have missed the most important thing about me and my work, the fact that I'm Irish. And you talk about a PBS documentary that was aired just a year ago that never mentioned his Irish heritage or the poverty his father was raised in. It's very interesting.
Again, and this was a documentary done by two people whose book I quite admire, Barbara and Arthur Gelb, the fellow who wrote Angels in America, whose name just escaped me, mm-hmm. the playwright. But these are very progressive people politically.
Is that Tony Kushner?
Thank you, Tony Kushner. Yeah. And yet they essentially elided or cut out O'Neill's Irish roots. And it, again, there's this tendency to turn everybody into white people. And I was shocked when I saw this PBS documentary and O'Neill's Irish roots, his famine immigrant roots, his father's working class roots in the slums of Buffalo, as the sources of this rich vernacular that informs O'Neill's greatest plays. First of all, his first plays, like The Web and Abortion, which he writes in 1913, 1914, are literally written entirely in the vernacular. And then later on, his greatest plays, like The Iceman Cometh, is written also in this rich, earthy Irish-American vernacular, which informed these great Pulitzer Prize and Nobel Prize-winning plays. And yet nobody seeks to root O'Neill in his where he belongs, in the soil, the cultural soil that he sprang from, which is the cultural soil of famine Ireland and of the slums of Buffalo. And this is what informs O'Neill's work. And it amazes me when I hear progressive critics, especially people on a PBS-produced documentary, completely erase and cover over these roots with a shroud of whiteness. 75% of all the characters in O'Neill's plays are of Irish or Irish-American heritage. His plays are filled with the voices of Irish America. And if you want to understand the vernacular that was spoken in its richest period in the early 20th century in places like New York City, you have to go to O'Neill and read his plays. Hundreds of the words that are in my book I cite right in O'Neill's plays and show how they're used. Even by Eugene O'Neill in his letters, he spoke this vernacular. He heard it from his father, and his father was from Kilkenny in Ireland, where the Irish language had survived into the 1850s.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the Bowery Boys versus the Dead Rabbits. This was in New York City in 1857, a couple of rival gangs.
Right.
And you think that Martin Scorsese made an error in his film The Gangs of New York when he had the Irish-American defenders marching with a carcass of a bloodied rabbit. Why is that, Danny?
Well, you know, I'm a great admirer of the films of Marty Scorsese. I just love his films. Scorsese was born in Little Italy, not far from the Five Points, which is where these famous gang wars take place in July 4th and 5th, 1857. The so-called Dead Rabbits, the Dead Rabbit Gang. And my family actually comes, my other side of my family, in addition to Irishtown and Greenpoint, came from the old Five Points. My great-grandmother, Mamie Burns, was raised at 52 Division Street, which is five blocks from the old Five Points. And even as a kid, I had a sense that this Dead Rabbit story, which is in Herbert Asbury's book, The Gangs of New York, it's where Martin Scorsese got the idea, which was published back in 1928, in the 1960s and 70s, I got a copy of the book, and I read the Dead Rabbit story. And even back then, I had a sense that it was baloney. An Irish bell means mouth or speech, and oni means foolish. That it was foolish speech, baloney. I thought it was baloney. Because I wondered, I said, now why would a bunch of Irish famine immigrants, probably 40 or 50% of whom are Irish speakers, call themselves rabbits? It didn't make any sense. And why would they march behind? And in the movie, he has them marching behind, as you said, a bloody bunny impaled on the end of a stick. Well, I knew from my study of the 5 points, that's in 1857. In 1858, they founded Clan na Gael, and they founded the Fenian movement right in the 5 points, where they would march behind the symbol of a harp of gold on a field of green, which is really the ancient symbol of Ireland, the harp of gold. That made sense to me. A bloody bunny made no sense. It especially made no sense when I looked in an Irish dictionary, and there was the word rabid. And in Irish, a rabid just means a big hulking person, a big athletic fellow, a sporty young fellow, and a dead rabbit just meant a big lug. You know, dead in English is an intensifier. Oh, you're dead handsome, or dead pretty, or uh-huh. You're dead game. Well, dead rabbit just meant he's a dead big lug. He's a dead big guy. And like young men all the time in their teenage years, they always think they're big sporty characters. And that's all dead rabbit means. A big lug, a big athletic-looking fellow. There were real gangs in the 5 points. They may have referred to each other as a dead rabbit, a dead big lug. Hey, you big lug, you dead rabbit, you. But there never was a gang called the Dead Rabbits. We even have the New York Times has several quotes from people back then saying there's no dead rabbit gang. What there was groups of volunteer companies, young men and women, I might add, who were defending the 5 points from this gang, the Bowery Boys, which was a nativist, white supremacist gang that hated the Irish for their Catholicism and for the fact that they were immigrants. And they came in and tried to invade the 5 points. Over the previous 2 years, there had been hundreds of Catholic churches burnt all across America by these same nativists. And frankly, what happened, to boil it down so your listeners out here would understand, is that the Irish of the 5 points delivered a Sunday punch. An Irish Sunday means vigorous or powerful, a Sunday punch, S-O-N-N-D-A in Irish, Sunday. A Sunday punch to the nativist gangsters and their police department allies, and they beat them back from the gangs of the 5 points. And as I say, they got the 86. Yeah. And in Irish, 86 means a denial of hospitality or to be expelled from somewhere, just like it means in slang. They were 86 from the 5 points by the poor Irish immigrants of the 5 points. And that's really the story of the gangs in New York.
That's very interesting. And you also said that one of the reasons you were suspicious of that that vision of them marching with a carcass of a bloodied rabbit is because they were hungry and they would have eaten that rabbit before they'd put it on a stick and marched down the street.
Thank you for reminding me. I said, hey, if some Lugan, some idiot, had thrown a dead rabbit into a bunch of Irish famine immigrants, they would have grabbed it, taken it home, skinned it, and fed it to the family in a stew, right. Let alone walk around with on the end of a stick. So Marty Scorsese missed the ball on that one, I'm afraid.
Okay. You mentioned a song in your book, Paddy Works on the Erie, and you say this is a secret song of the Irish who came to America searching for work and freedom. How is that a secret song?
The words for a secret song in Irish are Sana Slay. And it's a Sana Slay because it contains within it elements that essentially underline the whole thesis of my book, that the Irish language is in all our gobs, our mouths, our beaks, on our puss, on our lips, that the Irish language is out there, but it's secret, it's hidden, it's concealed beneath orthographic overcoats, as I call them, misspelling, mispronounced. But there they are in the gobs, not just of Irish American people, but of everybody. And this is an example, this song, of how this language could become so concealed. Maybe I could sing a little piece of it for you.
Oh, I would love it. Go for it.
I'll just sing maybe two or three choruses. This takes place during the 1840s. So, it ultimately takes place even during the Great Hunger on Gorta Mór, the Great Hunger of Ireland. Let me just add that Paddy Works on the Erie is also known as Pat Works on the Railway, Poor Paddy Works on the Railroad, and was collected by Carl Sandburg first in the 1920s and is later contained in the 1934 collection American Ballads and Folk Songs by the famous team of John, father and son team of John and Alan Lomax. And it's one of the most recorded songs in American history and arguably one of the great 10 great American folk songs. And I'll just sing a little piece of it for you, and then I'll deal with the interesting and mysterious chorus, which I say is a Sanas Leia secret song. In 1841, I put me corduroy breeches on. I put me corduroy breeches on to work upon the railway. Filame orierie, filame orierie, filame orierie to work upon the railway. And John and Al Lomax trace the origin of Patty Works on the Erie to Carl Sandburg's 1927 book, American Songbag. Sandburg says he first found it on an old copy of sheet music in 1850. That copy's never been found, and the earliest one is from 1864. In 1842, I left the old world for the new. Bad cess to the luck that brought me through to work upon the railway. Filame orierie, filame orierie, filame orierie, to work upon the railway. Now, the lyrics of this song vary widely. I mean, there's local versions that are scattered all across the mid-19th century Irish diaspora. You'll hear versions in New York, Liverpool, San Francisco, Melbourne, Sydney. Wherever Patty bent his back and laid a track, you'll hear this song. Recently, even lost cemeteries have been found along the old Pennsylvania Railroad lines, where they found, literally, it was just in National Geographic a few weeks ago, mass graves of these Irish laborers who had basically died from typhus, cholera, smallpox, and infectious diseases. And in Pennsylvania, there's always been a saying, every mile of railroad is one Paddy's grave. Our contractor's name, it was Tom King. He kept the star to rob the men, a Yankee clerk with ink and pen to cheat Pat on the railway. Filame orierie, filame orierie, filame orierie to work upon the railway. It's Pat do this and Pat do that without a stock in a cravat and nothing but an old straw hat to work upon the railway. And finally, as a note to your audience before I try to do a little bit of dricht magic here, linguistic dricht, from the 17th century to the 1920s, 7 million Irish people immigrated to North America. They played a major role in constructing the commercial and industrial infrastructure of modern America today. In other words, Patty was a working stiff. And an Irish stiff, S-T-A-F, means a big, burly person, a strong, husky, muscular person, or a worker. And so that's where the working stiff, as we said in my family, he's a working stiff. That's where the word stiff comes from. Ultimately, the question is, what about that mysterious chorus? Filame orierie, filame orierie, filame orierie to work upon the railway, which repeats throughout the song. I only sang 3 or 4 verses, it's about 16. And what does that mean? And it's always been treated in the 150 years the song's been sung as macaronic or nonsense syllables. Yet I believe that really filame orierie is the Sanas Leigh, is the secret song of Patty and Bridget. And all immigrants who come to America, it's a secret song of rising and working. Because filame in Irish means I will return, I will go back. Uar means hour or time. And erie means rising or getting up. And so a simple translation of the slightly mispronounced Irish phrase filame uar erie means time to get up, I'll go back. So in essence, when you're singing filame uar erie, you're singing, time to get up and I'll go back to work upon the railway. So filame orierie, as I said, is the hidden litany of labor, of Patty, Colleen, and all the working stiffs and all immigrants to America. Filame orierie.
Very interesting. And thank you for singing that song. Well,
thank
done.
You for letting me do it.
Well done.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Tonight's guest included Leslie Scalapino reading from her new book, It's Go in Horizontal, Tom Absher reading from his new book, The Paper Rose, and we also had a tribute to Daniel Cassidy, author of How the Irish Invented Slang. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's show, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.